Alan Lightman and Alan Brody.
Well, I asked Bill if we could, if Alan Brody and I could have a little time together to perhaps tell you a little bit about or reenact an unusual gathering that we've had for the last couple of years that Alan mentioned. We've had a gathering about every 6 weeks or so of five or six playwrights and five or six scientists at MIT. This is from 5 to 7 p.m., well-defined boundaries, and we have wine and cheese. You probably know some of the physicists who have been coming. Jerry Friedman, Alan Guth, Bob Jaffe have been members of the group, and we've had some biologists as well. And I think that it's worked very well because we've never had an agenda. No one's ever had to do any homework.
We had wine, so we didn't need an agenda.
We've discussed a wide variety of issues, and Alan mentioned a few of them. But I think that unlike some of what we've been talking about here at this conference here, the final product of having science or scientific ideas or scientific structure in theater, the product of this gathering has been the gathering itself. And the way that these two groups of people have affected each other and the ideas that they've exchanged. So the whole concept, a raison d'etre of the group was the belief that scientists and theater people had something to say to each other and something to learn from each other. So that is the product.
Yeah. It's what you discover, though, that's so surprising is that we share so much in the passion with which we work, in really what we're after in terms of understanding something deeply. But the big problem in the beginning was understanding each other's language. It was really a question of bilingualism. When I talked about passion, for instance, and when Bob Jaffe talked about passion, Wolfgang Ketterle talked about passion, entirely different, seemed to mean entirely different things until we got to the nub of the matter. That's been fascinating. One of the most important things for me is that, and this was very surprising, was what the scientists thought we do as playwrights, and how surprised they were when they discovered that's not what we do. That we don't, first of all, write with a fine frenzy and our eyes rolling. Okay, that we're not only interested, in fact, in the emotional moments, but the ideas. We have one playwright, some of you may know, John Lipsky, who keeps saying, okay, how can a scientific idea become a character? Okay, how can the idea itself, how can, let's say, a character have such passion about his or her ideas that's the driving action of the play? I told him to read Bernard Shaw, but he doesn't listen to me. How do you do it with science, with that same kind of passion with science? And he's still struggling with this, and it's wonderful to watch him struggling with it, and to have these theoretical physicists sort of trying to help him along, and explain to him how it works. But that's a question that's constantly coming up, and it's really the heart of what I was talking about before, which is how does this new openness to science really begin to force us to rethink what a drama can be?
One of the things that was interesting to me, and I would like to have you guys ask those questions, but But what do the scientists have to gain from this group?
Yes.
Because the playwrights, I mean, it's clear that there's now sort of a industry, a small industry of making plays about science, and the playwrights are interested in getting ideas from scientists, not only
so about you could get shared royalties.
That's right. Right. But what do the scientists have to get out of this? In particular, these five or six scientists who keep showing up every 6 weeks, what are we getting out of this? And this is my opinion, but I think that one of the things that we get out of this is we find out from the playwrights what in our own lives make good stories. And sometimes we scientists don't know ourselves what are the good stories.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you will very, not you particularly, but somebody will say, well, here's a good story, you know, and they will tell some sort of built-in narrative from the past, history about, you. Why don't you write about that? That's terrific. And there was this one wonderful moment when Deborah Wise, who's a playwright in Boston, asked Alan Guth to tell about what happened when he figured out, you know, when that moment of understanding of the inflated universe, he understood exactly how to express it and how to do it. And Alan said, well, you're not very interested in that. And but he said, well, I was. And then he started to tell how he had been working on it and trying to figure it out. And as he started to talk, and as he started to move back in his own time to when this was happening, the entire room had a silence about it that was so deep as we were there with him. And he finally talked about simply the intuitive moment when it happened. And it was like, I mean, it was an event, that was an event in a play. Mm-hmm. How do you dramatize it? I'm not so sure yet, you know. But he had no idea of how powerful that story was.
But we've told other stories that have gone over like lead balloons. That I mean,
well, you can't win them all.
That's right. but this is what we learn.
Yeah.
See,
right.
I mean, we tell stories not only about our own careers, but we tell things from history like when Henrietta Leavitt discovered a method for measuring distance to stars, or when Lise Meitner figured out how nuclear fission worked, or the physics behind it. And so we tell other stories, and some of them register with the playwrights, and some of them don't.
Yeah.
And it's something I think that the scientists learn, that is, we don't all, unless we're writing autobiographies, we don't always think of our lives in terms of stories. I mean, they're there, of course, but we don't give our lives epic proportions or whatever else, the tragedy and the thrill that goes into stories. And by hearing from the playwrights what turns you on and what doesn't, it's a way of us helping to organize our own lives and to think about them. I mean, we don't all have heroic lives, but it tells us what makes a story to a playwright, what has an emotional consistency or a dissonance or whatever it is that playwrights are seeking to, you know, in your mirror to life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, you know, you can see it when you throw something out and it does. But then there are those other moments when you'll see five of us, you know, just suddenly sit up, and you can hear the computer keys clicking in our heads. You did it once, twice, three times with us. And they weren't about you, actually, but they were about what was fascinating you. One had to do with Teller and the idea of the richness of the possibility of Teller as a character, actually. And why don't you tell about the business of the German physicists, the intern German physicists in England? I mean, that just blew us away.
Well, this is something that probably a number of people know, but after, during, at the end of World War II, when Germany had been defeated, the number of German physicists were rounded up by the Allies and taken to a building outside of Cambridge called Farm Hill. Farm Hall, yes, Farm Hall. And this was written about and documented in a book by Jeremy Bernstein called The Uranium Club. How many people have seen that book? Good. Well, anyway, unbeknownst to the German scientists, and they included Heisenberg and von Weizsäcker and I think maybe Max Perutz was there. These were all the Germans who might, he wasn't there, okay. These are all the Germans who might have had knowledge of the German atomic bomb project. They were secretly tape recorded. And many of those tapes have been translated and published in this book, The Uranium Club. And it offers amazing insights into what these men were thinking. During the time that they were interred, the U.S. dropped the atom bomb on Japan, and the news was brought to the German scientists while they were there. They were informed of this, and their reactions are recorded, and they're just stunning. At first, the reactions were disbelief, and then they go through a huge range of reactions. Otto Hahn was one of the Germans who was interred there, and Hahn was one of the first people to actually discover experimentally that the uranium nucleus could be fissioned. So he actually discovered fission experimentally, and always had taken credit for it, and he was devastated with this news, that he felt that he personally was responsible for the killing of all of these people. But you get their raw reactions in these transcripts of the conversations, basically unedited, and I think that would be a magnificent possibility for a play, to reenact these people at Farm Hall.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, the premise is just spectacular.
And you've got excellent primary source material.
Yeah.
So that was one of the stories that I told, and
it did electrify us. Yeah. Is there a question over there?
Well, I'll throw out an idea for anyone who wants to grab it based on that. The fact that many of the American scientists would not shake hands with Heisenberg after the fact, even though they built the bomb and they dropped it. Heisenberg was ostracized. The paradox of sort of American chutzpah and hubris there would be a great point.
Yeah. Should we take questions?
Sure.
David Cassidy, who's the historian of both Einstein and Heisenberg and recently Oppenheimer,
yeah,
told me he wrote a play just on the basis of that, and he's about to send it to me. So people have done that. The tragedy of the Farm Hall tapes is that they were, of course, in German, transcribed into English, and then the original German lost. So you really don't have the original words. You have a poor translation of it. But David Cassidy has written something, and I don't know what it is.
Well, here we are back to the uncertainty principle.
Right. Yeah.
I just wanted to go back to what you started asking about, which is why, just much more generally than stories about Heisenberg, which we could tell, about the affinity between the sciences, more generally than just physics, and the arts. I was wondering whether, to some extent, that's because both have suffered so much in the last 200 years. And let me explain what I mean by that. So, as you described, theater used to be central. I mean, way back, era of the Greeks or even Elizabethan theater was pretty important. And you guys are really suffering now.
Yeah, well.
Now, you might wonder why I would say that science is suffering. But if you also go back 200 years, the Enlightenment, science was going to provide all the answers. you know, the scientific revolution, after the scientific revolution, science had lots of promise. It's going to solve all the problems, not just the problems of the natural world, but all the problems. And there, that didn't work exactly so well. Created problems, and so there was a counter-reaction. And scientists retreated. And you've retreated. You no longer, you know, play the role you did in ancient Greece, most of the arts, or even, you know, 200 years ago. So both extremes, in a sense, have retreated from their position of glory in society. Science remains important, but it's retreated in its goals and in its own arena, has perhaps done miracles, but it has retreated from trying to solve all the problems of the world and address all the issues of the world, or of humanity. And the arts feel beleaguered and as well, and I'm wondering whether that's one reason for... So, the middle ground with all the power has been occupied by others, politicians, sociologists, religious leaders, heads of corporations, money makers. And if we look around for our allies, seekers of truth, you know, who've had to retreat in the application of that truth, for us, in many ways, the natural place are the artists. I mean, they're pure thinkers, pure searchers of truth, as we are.
As you are, yeah.
Both have retreated from trying to be, you know, as enlightenment, agents of the enlightenment, or agents of the muse, to explaining everything or dealing with everything.
Well, there may always be the danger of hubris in anything, even, you know, even the...
Well, I was talking about the danger of lack of hubris. In other words, both of us have suffered.
Well, it may be from hubris,
of lack of hubris.
Yeah, but the Enlightenment may have, you know, to resolve us of all ambiguity.
Yeah, but
as Faustus
so we've been
said.
Suffering. So I side with Wilson that scientists have retreated too far. Now maybe the arts too have been beaten back too far, and
I think there's also a more prosaic explanation for the affinity between the scientists, actually the mutual admiration and love, and the humanities. And that is, you hinted at that, is that the rest of the world is our common enemy, really. The money makers and the politicians, and particularly the social scientists. Because the social scientists claim to be scientists, but are not. They are politically driven. They don't admit it, but they're politically driven. The humanists don't claim to be scientists, and so they have respect for it. And I once got into terrible trouble when I was provost of my university, when I talked about the various departments and fields, and I said, of course, I have extraordinary belief and admiration for the sciences. I'm a scientist myself. But if I want to learn something about human behavior and human knowledge, and the evolution of human nature, I'd rather read a good novel or see a good play than read a paper by political scientists about it, or a psychologist for that matter. And I think that partially explains our mutual admiration.
I remember Harold Clerman was with him in Aspen once, and he was speaking, and in the question and answer period afterward, somebody said to him, where do you see the theater going in the next 10 years? And he said, I don't know if any of you knew Harold, they always talk like this. He said, I don't know where the theater's going in 10 years. I'll tell you where the theater's going in 10 years. It's going to be in trouble. It's been in trouble for 2,000 years. It's going to be in trouble for the next 10 years.
I don't know if it's been mentioned yet, but I'm reminded in this context of Whitehead's description of our suggestion of the relation between science and Greek drama, when he tells the setting at the Royal Society, when the results of the Eddington expedition were announced, and the dramatic setting. I think he goes on, and it's in Science in the Modern World, I think he goes on and in that description to suggest that perhaps that the very origins of physics, I think he says, lies in Greek tragedy, in the dimensions of Greek tragedy. I wonder if that's discussed. If you
well,
comment on it.
I mean, the first text we have is Prometheus, and he's a physicist. No, and that's why that's why Zeus gets so mad at him. You know, he gives humankind a little too much knowledge. Yeah.
I just want to ask a question about how this has worked. Other than you yourself, Alan, am I right?
Thank you. Alan, am I right? Have any of the scientists who have come been inspired to try a new kind of writing by this experience? I mean, you've been doing it already. Have any others begun to follow that path?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I know that that Bob Jaffe has written his first popular article.
He's in the process of finishing it now.
Yeah.
Actually, an interesting thing happened because when I was vetting this paper, I was having lunch with Alan Guth. And because I was scared to death of all of you, and he said, you know, this paper. As I was reading your paper, I thought, gee, maybe we ought to change the style of scientific papers, of the writing of scientific papers. Maybe there's something. You know, he was struck by the idea that structure changes with reality, so that if the subject is changing and the very nature of the science is changing, maybe he ought to start looking for a new way to express that, even in the structure of the papers. I was really very taken by that.
This could be very far-reaching, yes.
Yeah, I was very taken by that. But that's the kind of stuff that we're now able to.
Right.
Yeah. I'd like to get back to the history you recounted, which might be seen as a history of power and the way that power has been used to control belief.
Yeah.
And so and God might be seen in that light as well. And certainly there is a moment when science in the Enlightenment seems to take that centrality. And I think that a good question, since the Enlightenment seemed to give a privileged position to science as something that is a freeing mechanism, mm-hmm. that is about freedom, I think there is still a profound question whether that science as a central expression of the worldview might still be seen as a mechanism of the control of belief, a mechanism of power. And I wonder if your inquiry face to face might be a way of sort of redirecting attention at that exact issue.
I think that's absolutely right. I think, and you know what else? It what happens is that the subject itself only becomes a part of the fabric of this, not the structuring of it, but the subject itself only becomes a part of this when something is in the wind of change. You know, and the theater is sort of prophetic about it. That's what excited me about what Marcia was saying in the earlier panel when she said, you know, there's a sense that there's going to be a whole new remodeling, a whole new way of thinking about these things, and you can feel it sort of in the air. And I think that's what the theater is picking up on in terms of suddenly having science the subject of it. Just as, you know, the kings became the subject of the Elizabethan theater before they chopped his head off. Right.
Alan Brody, I wanted to comment, perhaps question, it seems to me at the beginning of your talk when you went rapidly through the history where religion once was the dominant belief of everybody, the basis of everything, and I certainly agree with you that science is a religion too, which we should deeply believe in. But I think the peril stops, because first of all, religion was really believed in and understood by everybody. You didn't have to be an elitist to talk about religion. I mean, there were, but it was ingrained in people. then another about what the Greeks actually, I mean, the Greeks were the ones who first invented science, actually, yeah. In spite of the academic, maybe because their religion wasn't monotheistic, and monotheism is a big tragedy, yeah. I think, for the religion.
But let me...
One more remark, if I don't forget it. Most people today don't have science as a religion. It's wrong to say that science is the religion. It really is only a religion of the elite. And in the sense of the humanists, of the Brahmins. Most people have no idea and do not really believe in science. They never understood classical science.
Yeah.
And
let me,
much less contemporary.
Let me challenge you on that in this way. I think when you talk about science, and when you're talking about your science because you're the high priest. And you know, in the medieval period, they didn't speak Latin. The peasants didn't speak Latin. They depended on their priests for that, but that didn't stop them, stop Christianity from being their religion. And you know, and there were hierarchies. And I think you're quite right. You can translate this into power if you want to, but nevertheless, it finally that power, in one way or another, conditions the way we see reality. You know, but I think that in fact, if you look at the hierarchy of science now, without its being without the church, without the church hierarchy, there's still a hierarchy. And we don't burn heretics stake anymore. We just don't give them tenure.
Oh,
well, I think we do. I think the scientist does.
On this issue. Oh, are we ending again?
Yeah, we have to. We just got the word. Yeah. That was fun.
Thanks very much. I